Today I'm going to talk about many worlds, many worlds interpretation. There's a book called Many Worlds? That came out. If you want to catch up on the sort of state of the art, then this is the book to look at. I think there's copies in the library. It's edited by Simon Saunders, Jonathan Barrett, Adrian Kent, and David Wallace. It's a collection of papers, and these papers. So it sort of Did I hear you say something? It's good. Okay, thanks. It comes from two conferences that were held in 2007, which were celebrating 50 years since the original paper by Everett in 1957. One of those two conferences one is held in Oxford and one was held here. For the one that was held here, you can watch the talks on Persa. And for the one that was held in Oxford, I think you can actually watch the talks for that as well. They're on the internet somewhere. This is a very nice book that contains sort of essays that were sort of based on that conference, although it's not strictly speaking of proceedings. Tomorrow I'm going to talk about collapse models, and I'm going to use a paper by John Bell. It's called "Are There Quantum Jumps?" So it's in this book, "Speakable and Unspeakable in Quantum Mechanics." This is a great book to look at. In any case, it has lots of interesting papers, including John Bell's original paper from 1964. So recommend. And there's I think three copies in the library left. This is one of the. okay, so I'm going to talk about many worlds. So I should give you two disclaimers before I do this. So first disclaimer is that I'm kind of I would regard myself. As an anti-advocate of many worlds, I find it a terrible idea. But for the purposes of this talk, I'm going to try and present a best case I can for the model, which there's been a lot of work recently, so I think there's a lot of interesting stuff out there. Second thing, I'm not an expert, despite being an anti-advocate. I'm very far from being an expert on this, and so I'm not sure I can do full justice to the subtleties involved in some of these arguments. So in particular, I'm going to follow, David Wallace's approach. David Wallace's approach is very much influenced by Simon Saunders and David Deutsch. They're all in Oxford. There's a sort of bunker in Oxford where all the many worlds people live. I think Emily has visited that bunker, so please feel free to sort of correct or at least elaborate on the things I say, since you'll have a fresher perspective than I do. I'd appreciate it in any case. Let's get down to business. So the many worlds interpretation. This was initiated in a paper by Everett in 1957. There's been a lot of work since then. Um, So here are the axioms, if you like, of the many worlds interpretation. One. The ontic state at time t is given by a wave function. You could take this to be the wave function for the entire universe, although you can, in certain situations, treat subsystems within the entire universe, or smaller parts of the universe. Now the wave function evolves. So axiom two, the wave function evolves according to the Schrodinger equation. And that's it. Those are the axioms of the many worlds interpretation. So the claim is that these two axioms are sufficient first of all, to recover appearances. What I mean by recover appearances is to provide a picture in which the world, according to this picture, looks like the world we see around us. You know, you have tables and chairs and people going about their ordinary, everyday, classical lives. So in particular, we have sort of definite worlds. And it's going to do that by providing a kind of, by telling a story about how a branching structure emerges. And in each of those branches, you have a sort of classical, quasi-classical picture of the world emerging. And B, second thing is to recover the usual probabilities, to recover the Born rule, let's see. So this is that probabilities should be taken to be equal to the amplitude squared. Notice that the Born rule isn't one of the axioms up here, so it's got to be recovered. So like I said, I'm going to follow as best as I can, since I'm not an expert on this. I'm going to follow David Wallace's treatment. His treatment, as far as I understand it, of these two, of how to do these two things, in the first case, in this case, is heavily influenced by the work of Simon Saunders. Over here. And over here is influenced by the ideas of David Deutsch. But there is a side from the work in the Oxford bunker. There is a vast literature on the many worlds interpretation, all sorts of different ideas out there. So you know, there's sort of something called the many minds interpretation, where you imagine that there are many minds and these minds latch onto different worlds. There are many different suggestions as to how to get probabilities that are different from the Wallace-Deutsch approach. But I think the most consistent and intellectually rigorous story is the one that's told by these guys. Sorry? Who's? It's published a book recently. Oh, really? I didn't know that. Okay. See David's book. Which I will try to do so as well. I wish I'd known that before I prepared this. Okay. So, how are we going? So, let's first of all talk about this. How are we going to get this sort of branching structure where in each branch we have something like a sort of version of reality like the one we see around us? So at the fundamental level, all we have is a wave function evolving. This is a wave function defined on the fundamental constituents of your theory, so the particles and field, and various fields. But our everyday experience of the world isn't at this level of fundamental particles and fields, but it's kind of at an emergent level. You know, we talk rather about you know, objects like tables and chairs, sort of the sort of bulk properties of those objects. So what Wallace does is he uses decoherence, and I'll talk about this a bit, to argue that at the macroscopic level. We have the emergence of quasi-classical worlds. In a sort of branching structure. And these quasi-classical worlds look like the world we see around us. Okay. So let's look at a simple example. Now imagine we have some quantum system and we're going to make measurements on it. And these measurements have, we make two measurements. First measurement A, then measurement B. Each of these measurements have outcomes, one or two. So you can imagine that these boxes have pointers on them that either go to position one or position two in each of those two cases. So the system starts off in some initial state. Then it evolves and it first of all interacts with the first measurement apparatus. So let's expand this out as a superposition of two terms. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to evolve this first of all past the first measurement apparatus and then past the second measurement apparatus. Okay. So this zero is the sort of ready state of the apparatus. I'm going to take these A1 and A2s to be the things that interact with this apparatus. So let's see. So I have alpha A1 B0 plus beta A2 B0. Okay. So now let me expand each of these out in terms of the basis associated with this second measurement. So I'll call A1 gamma delta, let's see. Gamma, so this is. Over here, and then A2 will be some other coefficients. They have to, it has to be orthogonal to this one. I'll just call it something arbitrary. And then we need that These two things are orthogonal. So this now evolves to the following. Alpha, gamma, B1, A1, B1 plus alpha delta A1 B2 plus beta B1 or mu B2 B1 plus beta mu. Okay, so we have those four terms. Yeah. As well. Yep. Being lazy now. Yep. Yeah, because I'm assuming the system continues. So, yep. Okay. So here's the branching structure that we're going to associate with this experiment. So we come in. Let's just do this. And we have a branch that's associated with the initial state. In particular, the branch is going to be picked out by the fact that you have these macroscopic the measurement apparatus is in a sort of ready state. And then we have a branching in the wave function, represented by the first step. And in this branch, we're going to the detectors being where detector A has readout 1. And over here, where it has readout 2. And this sort of represented in this equation because you have these two terms. And now we have a further branching. At the second measurement apparatus. And I'll just write down the associated outcomes. So this branching structure is there in the wave function. But there is a question, which is what picks out the particular basis I used for these apparatuses? Out the So why instead? We could have used instead, we could have used a basis that looked like this. For the detector A, for measurement apparatus A, we could have, instead of using these using one and two, we could have used this as part of our basis to define our basis. But why don't we do that? Why don't we want to do that? And the answer that's given has to do with decoherence. So we can show that if you introduce, in addition to what I showed here, some environmental degrees of freedom, I'll explain what I mean by that in a minute. I call that we have some environmental degrees of freedom in a certain state beforehand. And in the kinds of models that you get in physics, typically these environmental degrees of freedom will very quickly become correlated with your pointer states, because pointers are big things. You know, a pointer is either here or here. There's lots of things in the environment that will get very quickly become correlated with whether the pointer is in this position or this position. And there's different states of the environment that get correlated. I'm aware you can't quite see this part of the board. This is the back. It doesn't work. Okay. Yeah, I try, but anyway, I'll just write it here. Have essentially zero overlap in the Hilbert space. Okay. So this is that this happens is really a statement about physics, about the particular sorts of Hamiltonians we have in physics that tend to have the property that for large objects like pointers, degrees of freedom in the environment very quickly become correlated with them. Oh, and to say this happens very quickly. Those are David Wallace's words. Very quickly means compared with the sort of natural timescales that are at play in his experiment. So, you know, certainly if it happens within some reasonable fraction of a second, then, sorry? At the speed of light. Oh, yeah, I mean within the theories, in the theories it would decohere at the speed of light, yeah, because that's what governs the Hamiltonian. In terms of it doing the in terms of it having the role that it has to have to account for the branching, then the decoherence has to happen presumably faster than perception time, something like this. Okay. So once you do this, then you can see that we're picking out a certain basis. So we can see, for example, this basis doesn't work. If you look at this basis, then what happens is, well, it gets correlated. With your environment. Whereas, if instead you use the basis that we've been talking about, then you can see that this state persists. Right, A, what are you writing? A?
So down the bottom, you've got A, I, B, before.
Yep.
So if I.
Oh, sorry, that was a mistake.
No.
Yeah.
But now if I express A, I.
As a superposition of these things.
Of like, you know, some other things.
Yeah.
Then why won't the same thing happen? Why won't it become correlated?
I mean, it would. If you write, the point is that if you write. Anything else other than something which is essentially this, then it will become correlated to the environment. There's certain states that are picked out that, sorry, maybe I should write another time step here. That essentially, this thing persists in time. You know, so over, once you've got this correlation, this thing essentially persists in time. Whereas these things very quickly get killed, so that's the sort of point I'm making, and that's only true of these basis states. It's not true of other superpositions of the basis states.
So is AI defined by measurement?
Yeah, AI is defined you know, like the one of the lights or the pointer, say, points to this position. Or maybe, you know, a more modern operators would have, you know, a computer disk having, you know, a certain number entered into one part of the registry. So a certain recording of this event associated with this. Yeah. Okay. So the claim is that decoherence picks out a particular preferred basis. So nowadays, even among people who attack the many worlds interpretation, this part of the claim isn't regarded as contentious. The contentious part is to do with probability. Okay. So when you Oh, and I should say, these environmental degrees of freedom, you could think of them as corresponding, you know, either to some sort of ambient stuff in the environment, like light, if you had photons knocking around that get scattered off the pointer, then they would they could be part of this environment. They could also correspond to internal degrees of freedom of the pointer itself, things that you're not especially interested in, like the exact positions of all the different atoms. Maybe you're just interested in bulk properties of the pointer. And so the environment could correspond to internal degrees of freedom that you're averaging over. And it could be both of those things. So the environment is really just stuff that you're not interested in. In physics, typically the sort of Hamiltonians you have, yes.
Does this kind of imply that many worlds is a kind of cut, nearly kind of so called cut between measurement and not measuring?
Right.
So in the sense that like you're always considering this large environment.
Yeah.
And saying that environment's not self measuring constantly, but it actually happens at specific times.
So I think there is a potential problem here with the many worlds that this branching structure you get depends on how, you know, what you choose to call your environment and what you choose to call, you know, your system and so on, or your apparatus. I don't know exactly how people in many worlds. But it should, is it also the case in this approach that you get essentially the same branching structure for different choices?
Well, you get
the same picture here.
Well, clearly, because all that there really is on this approach is the wave function which evolves as quantum mechanics does.
Right.
And clearly there's only one answer as to what the wave function actually is. And so there are various different bases you could look at it, and which will give you different answers about the number of branches, but they don't care about that.
It's an important point in David Wallace's approach, is that all of this is emergent structure, and it's not to be regarded as part of the fundamental story. So the fundamental story is just what appears in these two axioms. But the attitude is that the attitude is that emergence this kind of emergent story is very commonplace in physics. You know, we frequently give an emergent story, like we say, well, this table, these chairs are, you know, we can define where it is in terms of giving an approximate emergent story. And that doesn't undermine that we have a fundamental account of it, you know, even in, say, Newtonian classical physics, in terms of some fundamental sort of particles. But we're happy to tell an approximate story because it's just an emergent story. And so the idea here is, well, the same thing. We're happy to tell an approximate story without being too concerned about, you know, exactly where the splitting happens and exactly where the splitting shows up. So that's Wallace's point of view. This is just emergent stuff you put on top of the wave function, but the wave function itself at the very bottom, fundamental level, is just what it is. It's just doing what it is. And you're choosing this because you get this kind of quasi-classical behavior in each of these branches. You have, tables and chairs behaving in a standard way. So the last thing I was going to say is the sort of Hamiltonians that we have in physics typically pick out these preferred basis states to be things that are fairly well localized. So. So fairly well localized in position and momentum space. And that's a claim about the physics, which is worked out in detail in various papers on decoherence theory. Okay. So. Yes, please. Yeah, yeah. And maybe Emily should listen here as well, because it's sort of.
So, in the first case, you've got the A1 plus or minus 18.
Yeah.
So I can rewrite that as B.
This, okay, let's go, I'll call this. So no, you're not talking about the B's up there.
No, no, no.
Just a, let's call it C.
Yeah, right.
C1. Good.
So now it's not going to become correlated with the environment.
Because, oh, I see, right.
What,
okay, so maybe the point is sort of over here. This C1, if you actually write it down explicitly, say in X representation, is going to have a sort of two lumps in it. Okay, and here this axis is the position of many particles inside this thing, or maybe just the average position of the this could be the average position of the pointer. So it's going to have these two lumps in it. So now it's just a matter of physics to evolve this through with the Hamiltonian and having an environment as well, and see what happens to it. And this will not persist. It will be changed radically, very quickly, into something that is entangled with the environment. Whereas these particular states are things that are sort of localized in position, and then it's a matter of calculation to show that if you choose the right kinds of states here, they tend to persist. They don't get very quickly killed by decoherence. Is that clear now? Okay. Good. Okay, so that's the first problem, and most people think that this has solved the problem of the preferred basis problem, let's say, why you have a particular basis, and how you can at least say that there is this kind of branching structure. So now the second problem. So the second problem is to recover the Born rule. Problem B, and this is much more controversial. There's been a tremendous amount of quite technical work on this problem, and I haven't studied that technical work in any detail, so I can't give you an account of that. And in any case, it would take two or three lectures, probably more, to do so. But let me just try to outline, well, first of all, what the problem is. And then what the technical work, what David Wallace has done to try and answer this. So here's the problem. Everything has non-zero amplitude every branch, let's say, has a non-zero amplitude in the wave function certainly happens . So you'll notice that the axioms of de Broglie, of the many-worlds interpretation, are completely deterministic. You have a wave function that evolves according to a deterministic according to deterministic evolution. So, for example, imagine we have some wave function, and it evolves. Imagine this is just like before, alpha A1 plus beta B2. It evolves So we have alpha A1 So corresponding to each of these two terms, there's a branch. Now, what if beta is equal to 10 to the power minus 100? Okay, it's very, very small. You'd normally say, well,
you can essentially
ignore things like that. You know, from a probability point of view, you wouldn't even worry about it. However, in this point of view, this thing definitely happens. Okay. This is something that is in the branching structure. It definitely happens. Not only does it happen, but if you happen to find yourself in that world, whatever that means, then the colors are just as bright. You're just as wakeful. You're not drowsy as a consequence of having a small beta. This world is just as good as world, just as real as any other world. So it's definitely there. It definitely happens, and it's just as real. Well, if that's the case, what sense does it make to say that the probability of this is equal to beta squared? Why don't we say the probability is equal to 1? Or even if we buy that we should use probabilities different from 1, why don't we say that the probability is equal to 1/2? It's just as real. We've got two worlds. Why don't we say 1/2? Now, we want the answer to be that the probability should be equal to this, the weight, so the modulus of beta squared, so 10 to the power minus 200. But how do we justify saying that? After all, we don't have that amongst our axioms in the theory. if you consider to make the problem even more relevant, you might not be too concerned about the practical implications of this, but you could consider having many copies. So I have n copies of some system, and then many copies of a measurement apparatus. So this will evolve to n copies of an entangled state. The first term will be alpha to the n. Okay, and then there's many other terms. So this term will be there, and if n is sufficiently big, then this will be very small. But nevertheless, according to this picture, it definitely happens. The world is just as bright, but this world doesn't obey quantum statistics. This is where you always see up. So you want to have a very small probability in some sense for these kinds of worlds, in order that quantum theory, the predictions of quantum theory, the empirically verified predictions of quantum theory can be true. But how do you do that? How much time do I have? Well, okay, I'm not going to have time to go through even part of David's argument. Let me just sketch the idea. So the idea is to say, well, what do we use probabilities for? And the answer Wallace gives is, well, probabilities are subjective things we use to help us make decisions, use to help us decide what to do. So. So they're a measure of agents' subjective beliefs. So this takes us into the realm, we have agents, it takes us into the realm of decision theory. This is where you have the states of your system, the things you imagine making bets on, and then those lead to rewards. And the reward you get for a particular bet is a function of the state. Okay. And your bets are going to be influenced by probability theory, but by the probabilities that you assign. So this idea of decision theory is something that exists in the non-quantum literature. And you can show that if you make some very simple, you write down some very simple axioms, and then you very quickly get to a picture in which probabilities emerge. So you say things like, well, if I have different bets, if I prefer to make bet one to bet two, so this means I prefer bet one to bet two, and I also prefer bet two to bet three, then it's taken to be a rationality, a principle of rationality that I should prefer B1 to B3. Okay. So these kinds of axioms in the context of this decision theory, and they lead you to what's called a representation theorem. This has two parts. First of all, there exists a unique probability distribution on the states. So that if you take the sum over the probabilities associated with all states, you get one. And if we have two bets and we prefer bet one to bet two, then I'll just write this down. Large S is the set of states. This is just classical. In the case of this, it's going to be the different branches. It's going to be given to you by different branches at a given time. But over here, it's just a set of possible states. Sorry, I'm actually not stating this correctly. So the second statement is that there exists a function which basically is a reward function. It takes you from the different outcomes to rewards for a given bet. and this function has the property that if bet one is preferred to bet two, then the expected payout for bet one is greater than the expected payout for bet two. And in particular, this reward function is unique up to affine transformations. So this is all the classical decision theory that's used that goes into this work that David Wallace did. Sorry? What it means is up to this. If your reward function is this, then this reward function will also work. This makes sense because this is just a scale. That's the, you know, like you make if you pay $5 or $1 billion and scale everything up, and then this is just some constant reward. okay. So the final steps in this is to actually connect this bit of decision theory to the branching structure in many worlds. So what Wallace does is I won't sketch this out. He writes down a whole bunch of axioms that are taken to be very natural in this branching structure concerning decision theory. So he has a. And he finally ends up proving that. An intermediate step is that he proves that if you have two branches that have equal amplitude, then you should have equal probabilities, equal subjective probabilities. And then that's used as an intermediate step to show that the actual weight, the probability that's used in your decision theory, is equal to the weight in front of the appropriate branch. So this is a very technical piece of work, but it does achieve these ends. So I mean, one thing one can do is criticize the axioms that he uses. But what is remarkable about this is that he starts off with a deterministic theory, and so everything is completely deterministic. And then by thinking about what agents would do inside this branching structure, he's able to derive the notion of probability, but at an emergent level. The notion of probability isn't something that lives at the fundamental level. It emerges as a useful tool for agents who live in this kind of world. And so that's how he accounts for probability. Do you have anything to add to the story I just told? Like anything? Great. So, good. It's sort of something that arises in this mathematics if you sort of have this decision theory. I think the attitude is though that is decision theory is something that lives at the emergent level. You know, if you have agents, agents are things that emerge in this structure. They end up acquiring brains, and then they end up trying to you know, maximize or you know utility, you know, to try to live, you know, the best life they can, and so they end up making decisions. So all these things are emergent properties, and then so then you get yourself into decision theory, but as a consequence of this emergent level of structure, and then this mathematics follows. Would you agree with that?
The reward factor is just a measure of how much you value various outcomes, how much you would like various outcomes to occur.
But it's something that happens that lives at this emergent level. It's not. So the certain things you prefer. So, you know, one state might be, you know, a blow to the head, another state might be $1 million, and at this emergent level, creatures tend to prefer $1 million to a blow to the head.
Oh. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm pretty confused also. I mean, what's the connection between the wave function and the probabilities? It seems like the axiom is just saying that the probability is equal to the square root.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't sketched out this part of
is the axiom that equal amplitude?
This is not an axiom. This is derived. There's a whole bunch of axioms here that relate this decision theoretic stuff to this branching structure.
Assumes that the axioms can be derived this result.
What are like some of the axioms?
Can you give us one that's simple?
Like branching indifference, so the agent doesn't care about branches if they don't affect the outcomes that he perceives. The agent only cares about how much money he gets, not how many branches are associated with
him. Oh, I see. So if you can get $20 from two branches, or you can get $20 from five branches, he's in. Right, okay.
So the idea is that the agent chooses what branches to go into?
No. The idea is that the agent chooses actions which will cause different branching structure to occur. So depending on which measurement you choose to make, different branching may happen. And so you're going to choose the measurement which leads to the greatest possible reward for you.
So you have a picture in which the agent chooses a unitary or a measurement, it chooses to do something. According to which bet he wants to take on. Okay. Well, anyway, we're not going to sort of even touch, you know, scrape the surface of this. It's a long paper, but it's I think it's interesting work, and it's an attempt to solve this problem. And it's just interesting that you can see in this approach probability emerging from a theory that doesn't have it fundamentally. It works. So. So criticisms of the many worlds approach. So like I said at the beginning, I'm really an anti-advocate. I find the idea horrible. So the first criticism is well, there's still a lot of technical criticisms of this work that David Wallace and others have done on probabilities. So a lot of people out there, you'll find papers in the book I mentioned at the beginning. So Adrian Kent, David Albert, Hugh Price, many others have disagreed with the well, not with the theorem, but with the not with the mathematical theorem, but with the with the argument. So one approach to say, well, you know, what's wrong with this measure? So here's an example of a measure I might give. This is due to Hugh Price. I might say, well, I want to treat all my descendants in all these different branches on an equal footing, regardless of what weight they happen to have. You know, I care about them each equally because their worlds are just as bright. So I'm going to use that as my measure. And I'm going to, my actions are going to be in accord with that. That would make me perhaps be very cautious. I wouldn't want to even take the smallest risk that might lead to some suffering, since in the many worlds approach, that suffering would definitely happen. Crossing the road would become essentially impossible. But it's definitely one approach. If you really believe in this interpretation, then you really believe that those worlds are out there. Just because you can't access them doesn't mean that there aren't horrible things happening in them. So that brings me to my second criticism, which is, this is not really a rational criticism, it's more of a sort of an emotional attack, which is that the many worlds approach is really distasteful. So pretty much anything you can imagine will have a non-zero amplitude. And so in this approach, it really does happen. So one example is sort of immortality. You know, in at any given time, there's always going to be some non-zero probability that you'll carry on living. And so eventually, you know, you'll reach, you know, 800. You might think that sounds fantastic, but actually it's horrible, because you'll have all the symptoms associated with someone who's terminally ill, most likely. In fact, very terminally ill. So you'll be suffering quite a lot. And also, you'll be the only person you know, most likely, who is 800. All your friends from your younger life will be since dead. So that's pretty horrible. Any horrible thing you can imagine, really, is there. So there's a sort of distastefulness.
Is it possible that if something has very small amplitude, it simply cannot be measured? I mean, there are no such measurements.
Yeah, but this is not about what can be measured. This is an interpretation of quantum theory. It's about what's meant to be real, what's in the ontology. Just because it can't be measured very easily, you know, in an experiment, doesn't mean it isn't really there. And if you find yourself in that branch, your feelings are just as powerful and strong as they would be in any other branch. So the third attack, I would say, is that this approach is potentially quite unstable to progress in physics. So there's very strong reasons coming from quantum gravity to suspect that maybe unitarity will go away, that the unitarity of the wave function will disappear. Penrose and Diossi and others have made arguments like that. So if that's the case, then the very feature of quantum theory upon which this the weirdness of the many worlds interpretation depends is quite likely, possible anyway, that it will go away in the next theory. So from my point of view, there's reasons to be hopeful that we won't have to continue to contend with this possibility. So tomorrow I'll go through the collapse models.